A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. You know, on this podcast, I get asked all the time, why aren't you talking more about people being swallowed by whales, Kaveh? Why not? I've heard you. I'm listening. I'm trying to be better. I'm trying to improve. And to that end, I'm going to cover it today. To help me do that, I have two special guests, one of which listeners have heard on this show before. He is T.J. Mitchell, New York Times bestselling author of the Jesse Teska Mysteries that he co-wrote with another previous guest, his wife and pathologist, Dr. Judy Melnick. T.J., welcome back to the show, buddy.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. In particular, I know it's not easy. You're in tomorrow. Can you explain that to me, how our listeners, how you're in tomorrow?
Yeah, I'm coming at you from the future. We live in Wellington, New Zealand, and have lived here for 3 years now. So for me, I'm over the dateline, and it's tomorrow.
So wild. I'll never understand it. What is tomorrow like? Is it nice?
It is. It's beautiful. It's summertime here. And Wellington, I didn't realize when we moved to Wellington that I'm moving back to New England. Wellington is so far south that I've moved back to the same latitude as Nantucket in Massachusetts. So we have short summers, and the rest of the year is kind of gross here in this city. Anyway, the rest of New Zealand is beautiful.
That is amazing. When I first talked to you, you guys had recently moved. It's been a couple years now. Do you feel like it's home, or are you still thinking maybe you'll come back at some point? Are you playing it by ear? What's the plan here, bud?
Yeah, after COVID, we make no plans. So we're playing it by ear. We are very, very far away from our families, especially because I come from the Boston area. You almost can't get further away from there. And our real home is San Francisco. We left our hearts in San Francisco. We love that city. Judy's mom is there. So we will be coming back to spend some significant time in the United States. But then again, we love New Zealand, and we may end up trying to shoot for a bi-coastal lifestyle on either side of the Pacific.
Wow, that's like a really bi-coastal.
If we can achieve that, but who knows?
Well, that's fantastic. I can't wait to see you when you come and visit me in San Francisco. I'm going to pretend that's the reason you're coming to San Francisco. You know a lot about being swallowed by giant sperm whales, but I feel like we could probably use someone else who might have more knowledge about this, who might have researched it a little bit more. So I invited Daniel Krauss, the New York Times bestselling author of novels and TV, as well as film, This is really cool. He's co-authored The Shape of Water and Troll Hunters with Guillermo del Toro. He co-wrote The Living Dead with legendary filmmaker George Romero. And his latest novel, Whalefall, received an amazing review in the New York Times book review. You and I both read it, and I think we both really enjoyed it, right?
Oh, yeah. And it's not the sort of book I would normally enjoy. So I'm not really into clock ticking thrillers, which this is a
clock ticking thriller. Very good. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's really exciting to have you on.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. And I will say that I don't think I'm a big fan of clock ticking thrillers. I don't think I've ever written one before. It's just sort of the subject demanded it.
Well, okay, so let's get into this book, Whalefall. Okay, I'm going to try and give a synopsis of it. You can correct me any point if I'm wrong. Because I'm going to tell you right now, you guys are both like smart book writing sort of literary minds who I'm sure excelled at AP English. I am more of a science nerd, and I apologize in advance for all the stupid questions I'm going to ask you that are probably laughable in your literary circles, but are honest questions I have about writing. And I'm going to try and do a synopsis for this book. So a teenager named Jay goes on a solo scuba dive expedition after the death of his father, who he had this complicated relationship with. His father was this sort of great Santini-like character. That's a reference from like the early 80s, I think, for like the old heads listening. In this process, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I think it's acceptable. He is swallowed by a giant sperm whale who may or may not be the ghost of his deceased father. Is that about right? Did I get it? How would you rate my synopsis?
I'd give it a good solid B.
Okay, well, damn it. God damn it.
Listen, B is pretty good.
No, for a doctor, you just told me I can go to hell, basically. You just I can't take that back to my parents, Daniel.
All right. What
could I have done better?
Let me give you some constructive notes.
Please.
I would say that we should mention that he's in the water looking for the remains of his dad, who when he was dying with cancer and his son never came and visited him, threw himself off a boat so he could sort of die in the waters that he loved. And I wouldn't say that the whale is the ghost of his dad. There's a sense that it may or may not have absorbed the spirit of his dad who died in those same waters. Or it could just be that Jay is under the effects of the methane in the stomach and injury and panic and is just sort of hallucinating.
Just tripping balls. Yeah. That's one of the things I really enjoy about it. A lot of times there's ambiguity in novels and it's lost on me. I'm just like, I kind of want to just know what happened. But this is one of the few books where there's a little bit of ambiguity and it helped me. I thought it was nice. It was good to have that to play with.
Especially Dan, because you use it as a tool. You use that ambiguity as a tool. You're not just jerking our chain as readers, and it's very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely agree. So we kind of talked about this a second ago, but how would you classify this book? I mean, like, is it a thriller? Is it horror? Is mm-hmm. it family? What I mean, do you have to classify it when you're writing a book? Does your agent or the whatever the company be like, hey, what is this? And you have to be like, it's kind of all these things. And they're like, we don't want that. We want you to tell us what it is. What is it?
Yeah, there's lots of stages along the way of publication where you get chances to classify it. And they're all confusing. I mean, when you sell it, you're usually classifying it as something. This is often it's sold. Books are sold kind of like it's this meets this. And so you or it's sort of like it's in the spirit of this. And so you're sort of positioning it as maybe
it's Die Hard in a whale.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah. I've literally heard that one.
Did you really? I was still.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been my experience that a lot of thing happens after the book is written, as you said, for marketing it. But what was your experience in actually writing the book, Dan?
Well, no, that's where I was headed next. Yeah. Like that's sort of, then you write the book. And so then it actually is something. And then, you know, I think the most technical thing that happens is that the book is cataloged. So in the sort of bibliography page of the book, at the front of the book, it will literally be listed as something. And this book has had, I think it has both benefited and suffered from this confusion about where to put it. It's often called horror, but that's not 100% right. It's technically in that bibliography page listed as sci-fi because it is science-related fiction, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that has confused a lot of people because if you're an organization that goes strictly on bibliography, like if you're someone who works in libraries, for example, you're probably going to file the book where the book tells you to file it. Or if you're making an end of the year list, for example, and I know this has happened because I've been told this, and you want to put Wellfall on your best horror of the year list, you can't if you're a library advanced journal because you can't. It's telling you, it's instructing you that it's sci-fi. But the upside to that is I think it has expanded my readership a lot. And that usually isn't the case when you have confusion, but in this case, I think has helped because it is being called general literary or thriller or horror or sci-fi or, you know, some combination.
It's funny because sci-fi is the one thing I would have said it's not, but it works. I mean, it makes sense to me that it's almost better in a way if you don't have to pin it down, but I know that's also a challenge.
I guess we don't have a word for fiction that's scientifically based, that's not like, you know, medical fiction.
Right.
Cetology. We should have it stuck in cetology is where it should be.
In what?
Cetology, the study of whales.
Oh, right. It's a
infamous chapter in Moby Dick where Herman Melville just talks about whales.
Gets a nice little niche there for you.
Yeah.
But speaking of the science of it, it does seem like you really research this quite a bit. I'm wondering where you turn to for this. You know, I've talked to Mary Roach, is a recurrent guest of this show. We've talked to her a couple times about her books and the process that she goes through to research books. We've discussed, I think, is really fascinating. And one of her books, Gulp, is all about the GI system, which I'm wondering actually if that played a role here in this novel. But how did you go about it? Where did you start? How did you do the research for this? Because it does seem, I'm not an expert in sea mammalian life. I do know the GI tract very well because that is my specialty. But how did you go about the research for this?
Well, I will tell you that my favorite review of this book, which I just got, was from Smithsonian Magazine because it was reviewed by a whale scientist. And so it was the first time I actually was like, I did it. I pulled it off in front of the whale scientist. But yeah, Mary Roach was a key point of how this book got written, actually. So when I had the idea one night and then wrote her first thing the next morning and asked her, hey, have you ever, in all your interviews, talked to anyone who said you could live inside of a whale? And at that moment, I had really forgotten that she'd written Gulp. I even owned Gulp, but I just had forgotten. Yeah. And she says, yeah, go get Gulp from your bookshelves. And there's like two pages where I talked to this guy who said it could happen. And so she connected me with him. And I talked to him that day and he sort of reiterated it. He's like, yeah, if it's specifically a sperm whale, it was a big sperm whale and the diver was slender enough. And as an aside, that was the beginning of me thinking of the diver as a young person because it literally needed to be someone who wasn't too big. That's where the character began. And so this guy, Paul Clapham, then said, you know, who you really need to talk to are these two other scientists, Laura Horstman, who knows a lot about whale stomachs, and Joy Riedenberg, who knows everything about whale throats. And so in very short order, I had them all on the line, and they just were, all three of them just seemed to be really excited by the project and were with me through the whole writing. And just I roped in other experts along the way as a need to know basis, you know, as I was figuring little things out, but those three were absolutely key throughout the entire thing. And they came up with a million great ideas and also prevented me from doing things that I wanted to do because it wasn't scientifically viable.
Like what? Would you mind telling us?
You know, I'd have to try to remember. I know that sometimes they would lead me certain directions and I'd be like, oh, so could he
be pooped out?
Yeah, I'm sure at some point in the first conversations, like I did an event where a little kid sort of in a quiet, ashamed voice said, could he just be pooped out? And so I'm sure at some point early on, I asked when I was really just getting my bearings, could he be pooped out? And I'm sure they said, absolutely not. unless he was like, you know, liquefied, of course, by the acids. So I don't know if I can think of any specific ones, but there were cool things that I wanted to do and ideas that I had that were definitely shot down.
Yeah,
but that rigor paid off because that you can feel that in the read that you're there aren't a lot of options. You haven't gone reaching right. for things that it seems like wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when we were talking about the movie adaptation, which is something we can't talk too much about now yet. But we were thinking, you know, you're having to choose what you put in and what you put out, and there's nothing else that can be put in because, like, there's nowhere else he can go. I've exhausted everything that one could try, as far as we know. So what's there is what's possible, pretty much.
It is interesting. I mean, we might as well just touch on it a little bit, and we don't have to go into great detail. But when I was reading it, there's a lot of components of it where I'm like, I could see it sounds crazy. It sounds like a difficult movie to make, but at the same time, it almost seems like it's inevitable, and it seems like it's going to happen. Like a Timothée Chalamet young looking guy who's really slender will play this and love the role because it's just him the whole time, just his face the whole time with some flashbacks. And I was thinking about that a lot when you're writing a book, does that ever come into your mind? Are you like, or do you have to force it out of your mind? Like, what would the movie be like? What would the music in this scene be like? What is that ever going on in your mind when you're writing?
Never. I think for me, entertaining thoughts like that would just be death. I really don't want to put any kind of primacy on any kind of other media adaptations whatsoever. I really am, although I dabble in film and TV, I really am a novelist, and that's what I want to be. And I would never change something in a novel so that it was more movie friendly.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that would be a hard no for you if you could? I mean, I know sometimes you don't have great control over what happens. It's famously people like that happens to writers when they make a movie, like Pierre Benchley, Jaws, I think we probably should talk about. But like, mm-hmm. is there something that would be a hard no for you if they wanted to cut out? You're like, no, this has to stay. Is there certain things, you didn't have to say what those are because I don't want you to give spoilers, but are there certain things where you just would not be willing to change for a movie?
Well, it's tough. There's not a lot they could add to it because I've exhausted all the possibilities. Inevitably, there will be things taken away, though. And I can't think of anything that would be, you know, more important than another. You know, there's certain bits that I certainly like, but in his survival, like, you know, maybe that, you know, if they said we can't afford to build the second chamber of the stomach, well, that'd be a huge bummer, but it's not like this, it would be the killer that would ruin the movie, you know?
Well, look, can I tell you what I think?
Yeah. Right? Cause I don't have a good answer here.
I'm going to tell you what I think they might want to change, and I'll just beep this when it plays so people can't really hear what it is and they'll think it's something really dramatic. But in the process, in his attempts to escape, he loses his I felt like that was the one thing they're probably gonna be like, oh, he's been through a lot already, to make him go through that, it seems like too much. And I feel like that would be the thing that would just get like cut. But I'm wondering, I mean, how important would that be to you? Or is that something that you think would not be a major fundamental theme that would be important?
I feel like I'm on Meet the Press, and they always say, like, I don't want to deal in theoreticals. I don't know. Like, I know the director, who's not been made public, really likes the sense of at the end of it, how physically torn up he is. So yeah. I think some of that will be maintained. You know, really specific questions like that, though, I don't really know.
So let me ask you about that too, because you put this kid through a lot, this character, you put him through a lot mentally and physically. And it's a ordeal that he's forever altered because of. And I know this is a stupid question, but why? Was it just what you felt was natural? Is it what you felt was realistic? Is it what you felt was important to make this, to give the story weight? Or was it just where the story had to go?
Or is it because that's every man's journey with his dad, which is one of the things that this book is about.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things that just felt right about beating the crap out of this kid. Number one is just that, you know, it's crazy to think I went light on him, but it could have been a lot worse. Like, there are numerous moments in the book where he could have easily been killed. You know, he at least makes it until the end of his air tank. I guess I won't tell you what happens at the very end.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a sense of wanting him to be physically destroyed by the end to sort of kind of counterpoint how, against all odds, he's almost spiritually healed at the end. Like, in some ways, he's ending this in a much better spot than where he started, even though physically he's, you know, in the worst spot of all. But you know, if he can live through this, you get the sense that even though he's torn to pieces, he's going to be okay. In fact, he's going to be a little bit better. And it's sort of what TJ was saying. It is, the whole thing is sort of a physicalization of the kind of mental strain and fight he's had all his life with his dad, which often was physical.
Who's a fantastic character, by the way. The way that you draw the dad as the book progresses is really remarkable.
Thank you.
I agree. You know what? I'm a guy who didn't grow up with religion. I definitely didn't grow up with any church, no Christian Catholic background here. But I do, and tell me, maybe it's just coincidence, but I felt like there's a lot of religious themes through this book. And I have to ask, you know, growing up and reading, especially then when I was growing up, all the English classes, all the AP English classes were like a separate piece, and all these like great books, very Western centric. And they always had religious themes. And it was always like, don't you see, it's a Jesus reference. And I was always like, yeah, sure. But what? So like, why does that make a book better? So let me ask you, why do people put religious themes in books? Is it to somehow help people understand religion in a way, or is it just because it seems cooler and smarter if you do? Tell me why.
The main reason is that I want to be cool and smart.
Worked, buddy.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, I'm not a religious person at all, but I write a lot about religion because I find it endlessly fascinating. It's one of the things that I just can't stop writing about, although I have no particular belief system myself. In when I came to a Wellfall, I knew that people would bring a couple things to the table with them. Like, they would probably bring Moby Dick. Maybe they'll bring a little bit of Pinocchio. But the biggest thing they'd probably bring was Jonah. Like, everyone knows the story of Jonah. And it is this, it's not just a biblical tale. It goes back before the Bible. It is like one of the first stories people came up with, this idea of being swallowed, you know? And so we kind of go through life, I think, with our brains, with a memory of this time, not just the myth of it, but the real time when we were early humans and could be swallowed and chewed up and eaten by things. And that kind of caveman part of the brain is still in there and can be triggered. And I think that's why this story in history and in Wellfall specifically gets such an immediate reaction from people when they hear the sort of plot synopsis of it. So as long as these things are there, we're going to give them anyway. In this case, Jonah. I was like, well, let's use it, you know? And some of the other things like Steinbeck, that's just because you can't walk 2 feet in Monterey, California without seeing signs about Cannery Row and John Steinbeck. So there were just things that sort of kind of like the whale mouth or whale throat determine how, what age the character could be. There are just these sort of outer factors that end up influencing the things I put in the story. And also I had this thought that and it's pretty blatant in the book, how Jay's sisters and mom, they go to church. They're just kind of regular church people, but his dad is really anti-religion. But he's not. He's kind of the most spiritual person in the entire book. You know, his church is the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I had this thought that that whales were sort of like his angels. And the reason I thought that was that the whales are mammals, right? And so they dive just thousands of feet down, but they have to keep coming back up to breathe. And I just had this image really of the whale as an elevator between worlds. Like there was sort of this underworld and then this overworld. It was almost like a heaven upside down. And it just started to feel like a rich thing to mine, not for religion in particular, but more like people's idea of wanting what Mitt, the dad in the book, calls awe. Like that's why they go on whale watching trips. That's why they go to church. They're seeking this sense of awe that when you recognize something big, whether it's a whale or a sanctuary of a church, it allows you to realize the presence of smallness, that you are small, and therefore the things that are bigger can create these certain feelings in you. So it's all kind of wrapped up in that.
The whale fall itself, it's right there in the title. A whale fall is a whale dying in order to bring life to everything else in the ocean, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I mean, there's something about religious themes that's really big, and there's a reason they last. There's stories that connect with people on some deep level, and that's those themes. I could see how they could get into your works, even if you're not religious. That totally makes sense. There's some important sort of themes that just connect with people. And it is funny because it is something that we've always heard of. There is this deep connection to this like tale of being swallowed by something so massive like a whale. But at the same time, you know, this was so original. I've never seen anything like this before. So that's what's really interesting about it. It's cool. And is a compliment to you, I think, that you were able to take a really old theme and make it like scientific and new and exciting in a way, which I think is very cool.
Well, the one thing that I did do before I wrote Mary Roach that fateful morning was to see if anyone had written this book before.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to me that in the thousands of years this story has sort of existed, somebody would have taken it seriously in a sort of, not metaphorically or sort of absurdly, but scientifically seriously. And I was shocked that nobody had.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard. It would be easy to tell the story metaphorically or as a fantasy, but the way you told it is
it quickly became clear why no one had tried
it. Yeah.
Well, so speaking of the difficulties in it and what might have been sort of tricky situations, let me ask you this. In the book, you talk about some things like echolocation, the sheer sonic blast that these sperm whales can produce, the suction that they can make. A lot of this stuff you talk about, some of it, correct me if I'm wrong, some of it I have to assume is just theory, because I can't feel like we know that much about the sperm whale. So how much of this was you working off theory from scientists who study it, and how much of it was maybe a stretch, or how did you decide to settle on those things that were kind of questionable?
Sure. I mean, I'm working with pretty experts who are pretty much, you know, really up on the latest on whales. So generally they were able to guide me and say, this is definitely known, this is largely accepted, and then this other thing is debated. And as you would imagine in science, over time, those things solidify. The things that people are leaning towards believing end up becoming firmed up into belief, and the things that are debated kind of that can go either way. I think there used to be, you know, just based on my conversations with them, there used to be more resistance to the idea of whale suction, that they can draw in prey. But, you know, one of the most convincing arguments, and I think it's in the book, against that is that whales have been found whose bottom jaws don't exist anymore. They've been knocked off in battles or in boat propellers long ago, and yet their stomachs are filled with squid. So there's almost no other way for them to be eating so much rather than sucking these squid in. There's one thing. So basically the book is pretty airtight. There's one little biological thing in the book that is still theoretical. Like, some people believe in it, some people aren't sure. And that is explained in the author's note. I don't want to give that away, but I'm very upfront about that this is, you know, this is a thing that my experts believed in, but they acknowledge that it's still debated.
Yeah, and that's what makes the book not science fiction, actually, that it is fiction about science, is that you don't go off on flights of fantasy. You restrict yourself to the science that you know you can at least probably get away with.
There's, I guess the exception to that is there's a part in near the end of the book where it gets a little cosmic, where he's in the stomach and he has like essentially a conversation with the whale slash dad that is, I don't know if you call it science fiction ready, but it passes through the veil of realism.
Yeah, it has that contact meets the dad sort of scene where it could be explained scientifically very easily. It's just him, you know, tripping out on lack of oxygen and methane and all that. But it also could be more than that, which is what's really interesting about the book that you keep doing really well. Speaking of tripping balls, stay tuned and listen to these commercials that are all about, I'm assuming, drug use, mostly probably dick pills. Sorry. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And we're back. There's a lot more I have to ask you about the book. You know, one thing that I really like is the pacing of the book. It's something I really appreciate. It's kind of like the movie Aliens works so well because they don't introduce the monster for so long. And the big things in that twist the movie and start it, really kick start it, don't happen right away. And it builds up to the point where you're almost like, when is something going to happen here? And then the story really kicks into overdrive. You do a really good job with that in this book. Like, is that something you had to purposely slow yourself down to get to that point where the whale is introduced? Is pacing something that you're really considering when you're writing it?
Oh yeah. I mean, pacing is a big thing. Every book has its own pacing. And that's one of the, like, I'm about 15,000 words into a new book that I'm writing right now. And it's like, it reminds me that at the beginning of a new book, pacing is always the big challenge, because it's the reason the first quarter of any new book is the hardest. Because I don't know what the pace is yet. I don't know how quickly, I don't know how short the chapters are. I don't know how long the sections are. I don't know any of that stuff until I very slowly figure it out. With this one, you know, I'm sure I didn't go into it thinking, okay, this is going to be the first book where I do super short chapters. Like, that wasn't a part of the plan. It was more that, you know, once I happened upon using the PSI as chapter titles, so you could see the air draining away, and the use of flashbacks, I sort of saw that the more often I can see that PSI clicking down, the more tense it is. And and the more you feel like Jay feels, like he's very aware of how much air he's got left. And then I realized by doing that and mixing up with flashbacks, it began to feel like you're gasping for air every time you had a little chapter break. I just really ran toward that and embraced the short chapters. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I tend generally toward longer chapters. So this was a real break for me. As soon as I started it, it just felt right. I didn't struggle that much with pacing with this one because I happened upon it early and it just worked.
Oh, okay. Because I was about to ask, it sounds like you're saying that you worked out the pacing in the course of writing the book. Did you do a lot of preparation, a lot of outlining for this book? Is this a plotting book and not a pantsing book? Do you know the difference, Kaveh?
Oh, yeah.
You know, plotting.
I don't, but I can kind of guess, but go, yeah. Please.
Pantsing means by the seat of your pants. It means you start writing and then you keep working it out as you go along. You have a vague idea of what you're doing. Plotting is you usually write a long outline and then start writing once you've got everything laid out.
I tend to be a plotter, and for a book like this that's so technical, it had to be plotted.
Yeah.
Because I knew I had to know where he was going to be every single second. So this was exhaustively plotted. I knew every single thing that was going to happen because there was a limit to what could happen before I was writing.
Yeah, and one of the pitfalls of doing that is you could end up with a book that the reader doesn't feel like every page is a surprise, you know, because you've got it all laid out in front of you. You could almost subconsciously give away the game, and you did not do this at all. We couldn't see the engine, underneath the vehicle that we were riding along in. I'll tell you,
TJ. You know, I was going to ask you that too, then, because you also are a very gifted writer, and we've talked about your books on this show before too. So like you though are writing with someone else. So do you have to be a plotter at that point? I mean, I can't imagine you can really fly by the seat of your pants when it's both of you, right? Because that could be kind of complicated. A lot of butting of heads. That must be a difficult thing to do, right?
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm feeling such an affinity for Dan right now, funnily enough, because I write with my wife, Dr. Judy Melnick, who is a forensic pathologist. She does autopsies for a living. But the way that we succeed as a married couple who writes together is we have no overlapping skill set. She has the stories. She has the science. She knows how police work. She knows how a courtroom works. And I'm one of those writers who loves to be locked in a room just wrestling with adjectives all day. So we never step on each other's toes. And so one of the constraints that I have as a writer, because in writing our fiction, one of the things we really wanted to get right is we wanted to reflect what Judy does every day in reality. So she never lets me get away with, well, couldn't they just find a bullet that's shaped like this? And then they know, like she doesn't let me make stuff up. Everything that we write is rooted in science. And I felt the same way in Whale Fall that Dan was not making stuff up. Oh, and when it comes to pantsing and plotting, our first novel, First Cut, it was largely pantsed, and then the second novel, Aftershock, was very carefully plotted. So we've done both, both ways of writing have their charms as a writer. I'll tell you.
You know, it's funny. I keep thinking pantsing. When you say pantsing, I think about the act of pulling someone's pants down. I did appreciate that approach in both of your guys' works. There's only one issue I have as a gastroenterologist. And again, I have to preface this. I'm a human gastroenterologist. I am not a whale gastroenterologist. But you refer to the grinding of Jay while he's in the stomach at one point as peristalsis, which is not totally incorrect. But really what was happening in the stomach at that point was segmentation where the stomach is really grinding itself down. Now again, I don't know what the whale people call it. They may call it the whole thing peristalsis, but in humans and other animals, the stomach will do some grinding to help break down the food, and that is segmentation. The peristalsis is the downward movement through the thing. So it's not totally off.
Dan, you got away with it with the whale doctors, but Dr. Hoda.
I'm just making one small point. But everything else, spot on.
Well, allow me to retort. I will say that, yes, the whale scientists always use peristalsis. I don't know if they know what I would assume they know what they're talking
about. There's no whale gastroenterologist to my knowledge, but
I did have a whale stomach expert. I don't know what to tell you.
It's all right. No, I'm going to have a word with him or her. Let me tell you what else I really enjoyed about this book. There is this theme of claustrophobia that I sort of picked up on, and I don't like claustrophobia. I don't not like claustrophilic. I don't know what the word would be, but there is this theme of claustrophobia, both him in very tight spaces, like a whale esophagus, for example, but also like more than that, his depression, his anxiety, his emotions. When you have those things, it can feel incredibly claustrophobic. When people are really stressed out and really anxious or really depressed, the world doesn't seem big and wide and open. Things seem really like condensed and small and collapsing around you. And I felt like that was really beautiful. I don't really have a question. I just want to say good job doing that. Maybe you meant it, maybe you didn't, but when you write something really nice like this, I think these themes tend to come out either way. But that was something I really appreciated about the book, that you nailed in a way that a lot of books don't do about those emotional trauma. Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that was for sure, I've always been interested in closed room stories. Like a lot of those are often end up being plays, but there's movie versions and book versions too. Where people are in a very small space and they're confined there for the entire work. And to me, I've always really admired those kinds of stories, because it really makes the artist have to kind of prove themselves, because you're taking away, especially if it's real time, which most of them are, you're taking away all of these sort of quiet tools that you have in writing a book, which are basically time jumps. You know, like we forget as writers how much we can get away with by cutting away from different scenes until you remove that ability. And then it's I've done two books now in real time, and they are really, really hard. There's nowhere to hide. There's no way to band-aid things that you're not as strong as a writer. So this to me was the ultimate one room story. Like I have my, like I'm a collector of one room stories that I love. And, you know, there's one that takes a movie that takes place entirely in a bathroom. And then there's that probably the tightest spot up until Whale Fall was this movie Buried, which is entirely takes place in a coffin.
I think of the same movie. Yeah.
Yep. And whale stomach, even tighter. So I really appreciated that from just a challenge perspective. But yeah, you're right. It does feel right. You know, like this book is set during the pandemic and during the flashbacks. It really does more than even normal. He's isolated and he does feel like he's in this cave. You know, he can't really go anywhere. The one place he should go to talk to his dad on his deathbed, he doesn't. He's just, everything seems to be kind of squeezing down on him, and before it literally is squeezing down on him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautifully done, man. Let me ask you about just writing about marine life in general. You know, Jaws, which in my mind is one of the few examples, you could disagree with me on this one, of a film that was better than the book, but it famously had an effect on shark life. Like shark numbers decreased after the book. I don't know if it's all due to the book, but certainly did it help the public perception of sharks. And Peter Benchley himself expressed remorse about writing it for that reason. He actually went further to be like a conservationist. He would pretty passionately advocate for the protection of sharks. But when you write about marine life, was Jaws in your mind, the effect it had? Was that in your mind at all when you were writing about this?
That's really interesting. Because I thought about Jaws a lot. I really like Jaws. I really like the book as well. And I'm very aware of the work that Peter and Wendy Benchley did throughout Peter's life. And Wendy's still doing it. I mean, they're tremendous people. But I knew I wanted this. I wanted the whale to be, as much as I love Jaws, I wanted the whale to be the opposite of Jaws. Like, it's not the villain. It's not, it has no nefarious intent upon Jay. It almost doesn't even know Jay is there. It's more like a god, you know, like Jay just got swallowed up, and until he does something in the stomach that pains the whale could not care less. And I liked that kind of almost Lovecraftian feel to it, where like there's just these gods and we are specks of flotsam to them. We mean nothing to them. Again, it works into that theme of awe as really what religion is.
The whale is a force of nature. It's just part of the ocean that where everything can kill you. And that's why I thought it was also a great idea to set it specifically at Cathedral Beach. Like, why did you set it in Monterey in particular?
Monastery Beach.
Monastery Beach.
I set the book in, so just south of Monterey is Monastery Beach. So named because there's a monastery there that overlooks the beach. And I chose that because one of my diving experts, before I started writing the book, and I was interviewing him, and I was getting his take on where I should set the book. And he lives in Monterey, so he was biased, but he was like, look, there's this beach out here that's one of the most dangerous beaches in the country. And it has this nickname, Mortuary Beach, because it's so dangerous. And I thought, ooh, I like that. Mm-hmm. And then the bonuses were all packed in. It was dangerous, had a cool name. There were sperm whales there just off the coast. There was a monastery which worked into sort of the spiritual elements of the book. It just seemed perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a lively fishing community too. So you can, mm-hmm. you could easily develop that job for the two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up not far from there, and it was real nice. It was nice to read about that. I mean, you could tell that you sort of had, I don't know if you actually have any background there, but it was sort of a loving depiction of the area, despite like the downsides of it, it being a dangerous beach, the beach community, diver community being sort of mean to Jay in general. There is sort of like this affection that's clear from it that I really appreciated. And it is a beautiful area. It's a perfect setting for it. How much scuba diving knowledge did you have before all this? Because you write about it in great detail, and I don't know scuba diving, but it seems like you also studied that really well. Was that something you actually do, or is that just something you researched?
I learned to do it for the book. I had never done it before. And I'm far, far, far from an expert now. I mean, I just learned the basics. Just could understand what the suit feels like, what it sounds like in there, just kind of the real basics. I know he was going to be in a scuba suit the whole time. But I have, you know, I grew up in landlocked Iowa and live in Chicago. Before starting this book, I had no knowledge of whales, very little of the ocean, none in scuba diving. This was the ultimate don't write what you know book. Because although I knew nothing about any of these things, I was excited to dive into all of them, so to speak. And I did know a lot about the father-son thing. So there was part of it that I was really plugged into. I just needed to learn to take several months and just study all these other things sort of intensively.
That's commitment, TJ. How many autopsies have you done?
I have witnessed one autopsy, and that was enough.
All right, we got to get you cutting into some yourself. Okay, let's cut it. That I've kept you for so long. last thing I'm going to ask, and it's not really a question, but have you heard of the Decemberist song, Mariner's Revenge?
Maybe. It does sound familiar.
After this book, it is my second favorite piece of art about being swallowed by a whale. If you have the time and opportunity, I would like you and all our listeners to listen to the Mariner's Song by the Decemberists. It's a fantastic piece.
No, I just checked my music library, and I do have some Decemberist stuff, but not that one. So this is new to me.
That's the best. The guy's a great writer, too, by the way. He actually writes books, but like that's such a literary band, and that song in particular. But anyways, second favorite. Being swallowed by a whale themed piece of art. Yours is number one, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time. What a great book. We obviously recommend it. Where can people find it? And what else can we plug for you?
Well, you can find it anywhere where there are books being sold. You can find me at danielkraus.com. I don't know. I've got my next adult book is out next fall. Will be more aggressively announced in a couple months. And then I've got a World War I set novel that is coming out the fall after that. So those are the next two things anyway.
And I'm assuming you can't say anything about the next book that's coming out?
Not really.
Don't worry, no one listens. House of Pod is squeezy.
I'll say this much. It is... it is a collaboration with someone I've collaborated with before, and that's coming out next fall. And then I start sort of this new book deal I have with Simon & Schuster. And the first one of that will be the World War One.
Okay. Very cool. Great. Yeah. TJ, where can people find your delightful books as well?
Probably the best place is, our website is drworkingstiff.com, drworkingstiff.com. That's a reference to the title of our first book, which was called Working Stiff. That's a nonfiction book. And then the two novels, First Cut and Aftershock. Or if you look for my co-author's last name, Melinek, M-E-L-I-N-E-K, you can find our works. Don't try Googling Thomas Mitchell. That's me. Cause there's a million of us.
That's right. Actually, TJ Mitchell, if you Google you, it's you and a football player. So, I mean,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Not much of a difference there. It's pretty much the same. All right. You guys are great. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. If you haven't already, please rate and review us at iTunes. Thank you to Nadim for help with production. You guys rock. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.